Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm on location today talking on a telephone, so there won't be quite the technical quality of a normal program where I'm in studio. But there's certainly going to be a reason for you to listen, because you're going to get insights that are so rare. Why? Because we're going to be hearing from an individual who has spent 30 years inside the World Bank, an individual who has been able to develop enormous insights into how the World Bank operates, whose interest does it really serve, and what association does the World Bank have with the International Monetary Fund and also other organizations like the World Trade Organization, if any. Now, we've been led to believe these are all separate entities, and they're all there for the common good of those individuals and countries that are finding a difficult time and need a loan to get through. The public picture is that they want to help people. Let's say you've had drought, or you don't have access to good roads, or you're not fully exploiting your natural resources, and that would help your country. This is the excuse we've been given, that in comes the criteria. But there's all kinds of strings attached, including one of the most lethal policies for economic devastation to the average person ever. It's called a structural adjustment. My guest from Switzerland, Peter Koenig, that's K-O-E-N-I-G. He is a former economist and water resource specialist for the World Bank, where he was employed for over 30 years. He's a native of Switzerland. He's traveled extensively throughout the world, especially through South America, working on numerous World Bank development and environmental projects. He's a regular contributor to Global Research. He's the author of a fictionalized novel based upon his work and observations with the World Bank called Implosion, an economic thriller about war, environmental destruction, and corporate greed. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
Hi, Gary. Good to hear you again. I know you're in Texas, and I was hoping to talk to you today and that you are safe, which is not always sure in our world today.
I'm filming and because there's a water crisis going on right now in the United States. There's such a severe water crisis that 25 states, half the United States, continental United States, simply does not have enough water supplies to support all of its needs, its commercial needs, its industrial needs, its agricultural needs, and its human needs. And hence, the major cities like Los Angeles, I'm down in Houston today because they're running low on water. Dallas is really running short on water. And so now they're having to confiscate 10,000 farms and ranches, flood them with 75,000-acre lake just so the people in Dallas can have water for their lawns. And by the way, almost 40% of all the water that Dallas uses is for lawn use, not for drinking. And this is happening across America. 1,221 communities representing 6 million people in Texas alone have 3 months to a year and a half worth of water, and then they're out. At the same time, guess who comes to the rescue? Guess who gets to really feed off of a $7 billion pipeline that's going to feed water into Dallas, into this lake? The multinational corporations, almost all of them aligned with the World Trade Organization, and they have interlocking boards of directors. From here, I go up to Oklahoma City, then Kansas City, and then up to about 14 places in California, all of them facing the same dilemma. And yet we're not doing a damn thing about it except privatizing the rights to exploit it. We're not telling people you shouldn't be in these cities. We're not telling people you shouldn't be living near the ocean. You don't hear anyone in Miami saying that it's not in the far future, but the near future, the very near future, that we're going to see a rise in sea levels because of the unstoppability of the great ice sheet in Antarctica breaking off. And that's the size of a state, not just a small iceberg we're talking about. It's a huge mass, which could raise water level a foot overnight in all the oceans.
and what that would do to storm surges and tidal surges and salinization, salty soil, which would kill crops and destroy property values of 50,000 people living on the ocean. No one's talking about this. Everyone in America, in these government agencies, federal agencies, local agencies, are so terrified to tell the truth about water and how we're running out of it in some places. We have an abundant amount in other places. I mean, we have some states that have more than enough water. Others, there's no way in the world in 10 years from now, Phoenix and other cities going to be able to, or Los Angeles going to be able to survive. They'll have to do radical cutbacks. That said, you're unusual because you were inside the belly of the beast. You're one of the highest ranking people to ever speak out about what you really saw, what really goes down in the powers of quarter with an organization that was once run by Paul Wolfowitz, if you can believe that, one of the leading cheerleaders for the neocon movement and the war in Iraq. No one held him accountable for all that he did that was wrong, that caused massive suffering. And you see today the consequences of Wolfowitz and David Perl and all the other Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld,
Solik,
all these people. They caused what is happening now today in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and all over the Middle East. And yet your organization that you once belonged to, in my personal opinion, was one of the most pernicious, corrupt institutions that caused more economic suffering to more people because of how they gave money, who they gave it to, and the structural adjustment criteria that they required for the rich and powerful to get this money. Rarely, if ever, did a penny go to the average person. And then what were sustainable countries all over the world suddenly found themselves not only in debt, but having to give away their private resources, no longer being subsidized, no free education in some cases, no free fuel. That's my feeling. Now, I can be completely wrong, and if I am, please challenge it, and then take us through what you know step by step. You'll be uninterrupted because this is a classroom on the air, and that's why we've devoted an entire hour for you to discuss this. The forum is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Gary. Yes, I totally agree with you. It is an institution that has turned, I would say, almost 180 degrees since I joined it in the early 70s. But those are past days, and of course, already then they obeyed to the masses that be, which is the United States. It was a little bit different then, but in the meantime, absolutely, since the 1980s, the neocons took over. But they took over like nobody else took over. Not even the Catholic Church took over the world in 2000 years the way the neocons took over the world in 20 years or less. It is really unbelievable. And you were talking about water, and water is just one of those things that is on the number one list of privatization of these institutions as part of the structural adjustment, which has in the meantime gotten many different names. You know, it's budget support, it's all sorts of things, but basically it's the same thing. It's structural adjustment. And structural adjustment means you get a piece, you get a loan, but you have to do what we tell you to do. Most of it is privatizing. And what does privatizing mean? It means to give public money to a private company to manage or make profit of. That in itself is already a criminal act vis-a-vis the population of a country. I can't call it any different than high criminality. And this is going on all over the place. I remember the times when, that is in the early 90s, 94, when the apartheid system in South Africa collapsed and Mandela took over. And he was one of those genuine people who did not really know how the world works. And the IMF and the World Bank at that time, like vultures, they were just waiting that to happen. Then they descended upon the country and privatized just about everything. And one of the worst things they did is privatizing the water system. that, that meant that the townships, which are the slums basically around the bigger cities, they now didn't get any more free water that they had. And they had a reasonable supply of free water. It wasn't perfect, but it was reasonable and low cost or free, and people had access to water. Now, with the privatization, the big corporations that came in, they increased the tariffs, because big corporations, of course, they don't work for the public. They work for their profits. And so there is absolutely nothing free anymore. And the prices went up to the point that that the people in the townships, many of them, couldn't afford anymore to pay for the water. So they went back to their traditional sources, which were ponds and water streams and what have you, just water that was polluted that they were using maybe 10, 20, or 30 years before, because they couldn't afford the water to be paid, privatized water anymore. And what happened as a consequence is disastrous. What happened is that you could see by the year how the health statistics worsened, especially intestinal diseases of children. They went up ramp and, you know, in a rampant curve. And even the World Bank published these statistics, these worsening health statistics, while at the same time they were driving ahead with privatization. So either they didn't know what they did, or didn't want to know what they did, or on the other hand, the private the public health people in the World Bank didn't want to see the connection between the privatized water supply and the health statistics. It was something hilarious. I mean, sadly hilarious. And even though some of us talked about it with management, they totally ignored it. So this is one of the examples. And there are many, many, many of them. Now, in the meantime, what has happened, privatization is going ahead. They call it now, it's the same way as before, they call it public-private partnership. You know, that gives you the impression, oh, it's not just private, the public also has a word to say in it. What it really means, and that is the laughable thing, the public stands for the public investment, which is the infrastructure, and the private stands for the private management of this public investment, exactly the same as it was before. Just they call it public-private partnership, PPP. No, and the people, they buy it. They said, "Oh, okay. Well, it can't be that bad if it's if the public is involved." Even those who were suspicious before, they buy it. And what happens all over the place? Countries which bend to the neocon diktat, as many do, especially developing countries, which are most of them corrupt as the corruptor is. And they buy into these privatization systems, and I don't know any one of them that has worked properly. I think especially one that sticks out is Argentina, that has taken the reins into their hands in 2001 or two. I don't remember exactly the date when they kicked out Suez at that time, the French company. They kicked them out because they didn't adhere to the contract. They gave them a chance by a revision of the contract the first time around. I think it was 1999. And they didn't perform accordingly, so they eventually kicked them out. And that was one of the first and most important cases which made the round, publicity around the world. But that was just one of them. And the thing goes on, not only in water, but if you talk about water in South America, you know, the Guarani aquifer is one of the biggest, if not the biggest in the world. It could supply the world with 100 liter per capita per day for the next 150 years. That's just an estimate, including population growth estimates. So it is huge. Now, American companies and French companies, they're trying to buy land from farmers. And once they have the land on the area, which is Argentina, Bolivia. It also includes Uruguay and Paraguay. So all these countries, they are above the Guarani aquifer. Guarani is the name of an indigenous people, and so they call the aquifer according to them. It's huge. Another one is in Libya, which is an exactly a similar problem. But in the Guarani, there are lots of American companies that buy up farmland with the water rights, and eventually they will take advantage of it. Or they are privatized water supply in urban towns that are in above the aquifer, and therefore they have practically unlimited access to the water resource. And nobody knows what happens. They may bottle it. They may export it otherwise. They eventually, if they have a 30-year contract, they can export it by vessel, by pipeline, whatever they want. I doubt very much that the governments would interfere, because that was not foreseen in any of these contracts as I know them. And same thing is happening in the Middle East, of course, where water is really scarce. In Libya, where the U.S. and the NATO has made an enormous mess, and totally illegally. I mean, there's absolutely no word for what they have done with the Middle East, and the rest of the Western world, especially the Europeans, have just watched and done nothing against it, although they could have. They still could, but they don't. They're totally puppets to a system which is so utterly corrupt and criminal. Anyway, so that's what they're going to do also with this huge aquifer under Libya, which is probably about the same size or maybe bigger. It's very difficult to estimate, because science hasn't gotten that far to exactly estimate how huge the water reserves and these huge water reserves are underground. And as we see it, the U.S. has already tried, for example, to get a hold of the Amazon area by wanting to declare it as an international waters territory, give it to the U.N. to manage. Because it is precious, it's world heritage, it's water that belongs to the world. You know, fortunately, the Brazilians have said, no way, no way. Because once it's within the UN, you and me and many people know what the UN is. The UN that's supposed to be a peace body that has been created in order to stabilize the world after the Second World War. Is nothing more than a puppet of it, including all the UN agencies that have been created under the charter of the UN. They have become nothing more than puppets of the United Nations, of the United States. And what that means, they are puppets of Wall Street, basically, and they are puppets of the whole financial system. They are puppets of NATO, which is the war machine of the financial system, and the United States just lends its administrative body to it. Mind you, Obama, he is just a puppet of the corporate world. He really has no choice. His hands are bound. I mean, they choose people who have no backbone for these positions, and that's exactly what happened with Obama, just as a parenthesis. He has no backbone. And that's why he was chosen by the elite that belongs to the various groups like the Bilderbergers, like the...
Okay, here's what I'd like you to do now, if you would, please. We hear words like Bilderberger, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, but for the average person, they have no idea what it means. The media, without exception, defends them as private organizations, of think tanks, of intellectuals, and people from various backgrounds who want to see a safer, better world, and therefore anyone who challenges them is just a conspiratorial crank. Tell us what you know from your own research. After all, you are a scholar, you are an economist, you were responsible for very qualified information gathering, retrieval, and presentation for 30 years in the World Bank. So you're in the inner sanctum. You were close to those who were policymakers, so you have an idea of how it went on. Tell us about these groups and other groups that are actually not what we have been told, not there to serve the public interest as their primary responsibility, but there to create policies that serve the interest of major corporations and or ideologies they're affiliated with, and then from there segue into what you consider the most egregious crimes that should be punishable that were done in your 30 years at the World Bank.
Okay. Well, the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission and the Council of Foreign Relations, those are basically overlapping organizations. And, of course, since they are so secret, many people think about them, well, it's just conspiracy. Of course it's not. And the people behind these organizations, they are pretty much the same in each one of these organizations. There's another one, a British one, which is called the Charterhouse, I believe. And so they're all the same. It's different groups of elites. And when I say elites, that means corporate elite, banking elite, political elite, mostly from the U.S., but not only, also from Europe. And they meet several times, the Bilderbergers, I think once or twice, all over the place. I think their last meeting was in Denmark, if I'm not wrong. And what they decide is usually behind closed doors, and the media have no access to what they decide. But what they do is they actually map out what should happen within the next year or two or five in the world political arena. I mean, they created the concept of the one world order, or the new world order, whatever you call it. It's eventually one world government, which is supposedly going to be the United States with one currency, which would be the U.S. dollar, with one culture, which would be the North American culture, adapted and forced upon countries all over the place. All of these are long-term commitments that they have made to each other. And one of those commitments, some people may recall, Kissinger is one of the infamous members of the Bilderbergers, and of course of the Trilaterals, and of all of them, but particularly of the Bilderbergers with at that time Rockefeller at the head. Now, Kissinger said, who controls the money controls the world. Who controls the continents? Who controls the food controls the countries? And who controls, who controls the energy controls the countries? Who controls the food controls the world? Meaning that the people of the world, because they depend on food. Also, Kissinger plus the Bilderbergers, they have one big objective, which means to reduce the world population to about, well, their estimates differ from whom do you listen to, what I've read, from between 1.2 to 2 billion people. We are now at 7 plus. So that means that they will do everything possible, these Bilderbergers and Trilaterals and foreign relations, to reduce the world population. And that can take the form of wars, which we are seeing every day, and conflicts, but even worse with agriculture being controlled entirely by GMOs, genetically modified organisms. And you know that you can put whatever you want in these GMOs. You can actually program the lifespan of people. You can, which has already been tested in India, you can actually reduce fertility rates of women, and that has been tested, I think, in the late 90s in India. It came to the fore and became a short scandal, but then was forgotten. So you can also, of course, program that crops do not grow, or that countries who are in drought, you mentioned these disasters, the drought, and then the U.S. is very ready to come with food aid to Ethiopia, for example, and they tell Ethiopia, okay, we give you genetically modified food grains. You take it or you leave it. I think the last count I've heard that one of these countries, I believe it was Ethiopia actually, has said, no, thank you, we don't want genetically modified food. and so on. And this is also the big issue of the TTIP, which is the transatlantic sort of free trade agreement that the U.S. would like to push down the throat of the Europeans. And they may be successful, because we have a bunch of European government officials who are total neocons, and at the mercy, the foot-licking of the United States. So they may actually succeed. But there are some countries like Germany who still resists that, and to some extent also France. So it may not happen. That's the big danger, that if Europe becomes invaded by GMOs, that we may also be dictated, our lives may be dictated by the Monsantos of this world. And so this is one of those criminal actions you said of the Bilderbergers. This is driven by the elite, by the financial, economic, and corporate elite, which are behind these institutions. And the World Bank works for them. You know, one of the last things that I've heard about this horrible, about the third or the fourth big reorganizations of the World Bank, which most staff that I know are totally upset about it and think it's a disaster and it destroys the World Bank. I hope it does. But what Kim has done, the new president, who has also, of course, only in his position because he is a yes-sayer to the U.S. government and to the Bilderbergers, he has, when this reorganization, at least on paper, was finished, you know to whom he went to present it? He didn't go to the press immediately. He went to the Council of Foreign Relations, to one of the most neoliberal think tanks. And I think think tanks is a sick expression, to present the new World Bank. When I read that, I figured, that's exactly, I mean, at least it's transparent, except that most people don't even know what that means, the Council of Foreign Relations.
Why don't, so, Peter, would you do this, please? Would you give us an idea of what happens to the money when it is supposedly is lent to a country, who it goes to, what that country has to give up, how the people become poorer, how they compound the interest, how one country, for example, I know in Africa, borrowed $2 billion, ended up owing almost $6 billion. And yet no one seemed to think that there was anything unusual about indebting a country, taking its assets, stripping its people of any subsidies they have, and then when the people either die or become impoverished or start to rebel, then they say, oh, now we got to bring in the military. Now we have terrorists. Not realizing almost in all these countries, the governments, with full knowledge and cooperation of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the U.S. Departments of Government, were fully complicit in this. Take us through that, please.
Yes, absolutely. You're so right. And I can only, the latest example, I think I talked last time about it, is Ukraine. Ukraine is being offered or given, actually, $17.5 billion by the IMF. And the European Commission has, I think, offered another 3 or 4 billion in addition to that. 3.5 billion of the 17.5 billion have been dispersed before these sham elections took place. They couldn't wait until they had at least a nominal government. No, they had to be engaged in embedding themselves long before, at least a month before. It is just astounding. The country was already broke before, and Russia tried to help them, and tried to help them with a very, very low interest loan of $20 to $25 billion equivalent, with highly subsidized gas But then they started the Civil War. Actually, the Civil War started through the U.S. Through it was implanted by what is called today by Blackwater and Blackwater people, and what is called today Academy. It's the old former Blackwater. And of course, mercenaries from Poland and from the Middle East countries, wherever they could find them. And the CIA. The CIA was a steady advisor. They are still there. They're now accompanying the troops killing their brothers. But what's worse is that the IMF actually was instigating the Civil War by telling the at that time, not even temporary government, that's the coup government. They told them, look, if you're not controlling eastern Ukraine, we may not be able to give you the money. We have to reconsider. Actually fomenting the killing machine, which was fully armed and still is, and financed by the U.S. and by NATO, to go into the east and killing people. What they are doing now, actually, they don't even take prisoners. Most of the time, they just shoot people when they are hurt, when they are in control of an area. It is horrible. The media don't even talk about anymore. I know it because I'm also in touch with the Voice of Russia through people through journalists with the Voice of Russia. So it is an absolute disaster what is going on. And that was driven mostly by the money from the IMF and, of course, at the orders of the elite. Now, another case, an older case, which I know personally, is in Latin America. And when I was working in Latin America quite a bit, and particularly in Peru, on water projects, huge water projects. I was on mission there, and suddenly I realized, hey, there's a $600 million loan from the Inter-American Development Bank for water without any further denomination. And since I knew pretty much what's going on in the water sector in Peru, I went to ask the authorities and said, well, what is this money for? I mean, I was for the World Bank, and we didn't have at that time this sort of money. They said, oh, don't worry. This is just money. We labeled it for water, but the money just goes to the treasury and they use it for all sorts of things. We will not see it. We don't have any, you know the situation. We don't have any projects for 600 million. But you realize that you're indebting yourself for something which is not even going to the water sector. And what are the conditions? Okay. So they produced an Excel sheet, which was a matrix, a three-year matrix, because the 600 million should have been dispersed over a three-year period, 200 million each year, if they meet certain conditions. And so I looked at this Excel sheet and saw that the conditions for year one, which was already dispersed, or just about to disperse, I don't remember, but it was eventually dispersed, that the conditions of year one were not even conditions that the government had to meet. They were met already. They had done all these already before, long before the loan. So the guys at the IDB just went ahead and copied something, some legal points or whatever regulations that they thought would be a good condition to fulfill, which was already fulfilled, to have a reason, to have a justification, to give him 200 million immediately. Then for the second tranche, about half of them were already fulfilled, and then I didn't look any further. But eventually, of course, I talked to people about it, and I don't know what the consequence was of my talking about this, but eventually the loan was cancelled. I'm not claiming credit for it, not at all, but maybe somebody in the government became smart enough and said, well, we can't really do that. So the rest of the loan was cancelled, fortunately. But this goes on all over the place. And people, just as you said, they don't know. They don't know. They don't even care. They just know, well, the government receives money and it eventually has to be paid back. It has to be paid back by the public. And, of course, money like structural adjustment loans, this is the other thing that most people don't even know. If you, when we made projects in the 70s or early 80s, there were projects which had very strict procurement conditions. Of course, nothing is safe, totally corruption safe, but fairly safe. We could at least watch over how the money was spent. But with structural adjustment loans, they're just blank disbursements. I call them blank checks. There's no control how the money is spent. There's absolutely no control over procurement. So you don't know where it goes, whether it goes into the treasury and leaves the treasury through a back door into a Swiss account. You don't know. As a matter of fact, Switzerland is one of the countries that Peru has an agreement with for stolen money, that the money should be returned if it can be proven that it was stolen. And some of the money has been returned by Swiss banks. And about 2 years ago, a representative of the Swiss government, of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, was asked by a journalist, what do you think about this arrangement? Do you think it's a good arrangement that once a lawsuit is settled and the money leaves the Swiss bank or the Swiss treasury after it has been reimbursed through the Swiss bank and goes back to Peru, is that something good or bad? Or what do you think about it? Because once it leaves the country and once the law has decided that it belongs to Peru, Switzerland, or any other country has nothing to say anymore what happens on the other end. And this guy said, he smiled and said, yeah, well, it's a good thing we do it. But quite frankly, we don't know whether the following day it leaves through a back door and comes back to another Swiss bank account or another account in Europe or the United States. So this is really what's happening. And I think this is what you have to know. These monies, they indebt countries, they don't do anything for countries. Even the World Bank, I remember at the time, I think this was in 2005 or 6, the evaluation, the internal evaluation department has made an analysis of structural adjustment loans given out in the 90s. What did they do? This report, these reports are normally public. This report never left the World Bank. It was kept secret. It was even in the internal computer network. It was accessible only for about a week. And then it disappeared. Why? Because this internal evaluation department of the World Bank concluded that it actually did more harm, that it absolutely did no good, these structural adjustment loans, but in most cases, it did more harm to the country than good. So that says already something. Nevertheless, of course, the practice continues stronger than ever. So what else is done with this indebting? Not only is indebting by the World Bank and by the IMF, of course, a debt by itself, a huge debt, but it's also a leverage. If a country receives money from the IMF or from the World Bank, then it is creditworthy. Then it's good for money. That means that after that, all the private bank go into and lend them more money at interests either the same or even higher and conditions worse than the IMF or the World Bank. So these countries then say, hey, if I get money from the World Bank or from the IMF, I have access to Wall Street money or to European money. And they do that. So they actually sink themselves into huge debt. What does it mean? They're so deeply indebted that they cannot pay it back anymore. In other words, a country which is deeply indebted, the population, of course, suffers of it. The poor people more than others. And what it does, the poor people then have absolutely no time to think of protesting anymore. You know, they're totally submissive. They have to fight every day for the daily drop of water, for the daily food, to nourish their family, their kids, to make sure that they can find a health clinic if they need to. They have absolutely no time to think of protesting against the government. That's another way of making a country totally submissive to a foreign force. The other thing is, of course, well, if you can't pay back your money, we know you have natural resources. And, you know, these natural resources, they're worth a lot. We can help you exploit these natural resources, and then come in the Newmonts, which is the biggest gold corporation in the gold mining corporation in the world from Denver. They are exploiting Peru to hell, actually. And then if you want to talk another day about mining, I can do that too. I've been involved in that very, very much.
Now,
but anyway,
let's talk about it for a moment now, because mining is from mountaintop mining in West Virginia. This destroyed my home state's some of the most pristine areas. It's lakes, rivers, estuaries, creeks, with the trailings of the coal mine. From out in Utah, same thing. In Pennsylvania, same thing. In Tennessee and Kentucky, same thing. And then you go to some of the mines around the world, and they're even worse. China has 27,000 rivers that are simply so polluted that even the government is corrupt and as uncaring and insensitive as the Chinese government is. And it is.
Yes.
It's even saying, don't eat fish, don't use this water to irrigate your land. 27,000 rivers. Also, China has the fastest growing desertification in the world. So it's running out of land. So it's mining. Okay? Talk about
yes.
this.
Yes, and the same thing, if you talk about that, the same thing happens in Europe, in Greece in particular. You know, Greece was basically killed by the IMF and European Commission. Now, because they, of course, have to somehow find a way to pay the money back, because the politicians are too corrupt to having said enough is enough and we exit the euro, they could have done that. I mean, the legal ways of doing this fully, they could have printed their own euros, because there's no law in the European Central Bank, which doesn't even have a constitution. There's not even a regulation which doesn't allow a central bank of each individual country to print their own euros. They could have done that and given it out and pay their debt back. They could have. They could still do it. They don't do it, and they must know it. And if they don't, I have written to the government, to the various finance ministers several times about that. I even had an appointment at one point with Tsipras, the opposition leader, when I was in Greece a couple of years ago. He cancelled the last minute. So, you know, they're all of the same kind. But what I really wanted to say is that now Greece has to allow mining companies into the country without any environmental regulations. And many of these mining companies setting up their mines close to the Adriatic Sea, that is pristine water, ruining the fish and ruining the beaches and ruining the whole water streams that are coming down and washing these backflows from mines into the sea. It is horrible. When I heard that and read about it, I couldn't believe it, that Greece, a European country, a so-called, I mean, the cradle of Europe, would allow the masters, these financial masters, which we all know that it's not sustainable, they cannot survive much longer, allow them to ruin their country. It is unbelievable. And this is, of course, happening in China also, and it's happening all over the world. It's happening throughout Latin America with the corrupt governments, especially in Colombia and Peru. Others have become more independent in the meantime. But still, in Chile, it's not much better. So, yes, mining is, of course, another thing of that, another objective of structural adjustment loans. Mining, the extractive industry, could be mining or could be hydrocarbon exploitation.
Peter, let me interject and let me see how close to accurate my personal on-the-ground research is in South America, Central America, and other places. Let's just use a nameless South American country. Its people are poor, but they have historically used food co-ops, meaning one person grows lima beans, another person grows fruits. They exchange. They go to local farmers' markets. They exchange. They're poor, but many of them have some quality land, and they're not hungry. They have lived in balance with nature. But then in comes a president like Bill Clinton, And he, in turn, brings in all of the neocons and all of the so-called Kennedy best and brightest, you know, the people that gave us Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, you know, the Harvard, Yale, and other people who use their pedigrees and their affiliations and their frequently family heritages as go right through the line. You get in because look at your background, look who your father was, whether it's Cabot Lodge or Harriman or Kennedy, and now you're in a very important position. You're a policymaker. And then you surround yourself with think tank wonks, people who are also from best and brightest, and you then come to the idea by meeting with some corporate leaders that there's a lot to be exploited in, let's say, use one country as an example. Maybe it's Jamaica. And why should the people of Jamaica, who are fundamentally poor but not hungry, not living in dire poverty, why should they have an opportunity to be isolated? So we're going to subsidize American potatoes and American corn and non-fat dry milk. And we're going to load this in through a treaty like NAFTA into we're going to give all this at below cost into Jamaica and in other countries. And everything they grow in Jamaica that feeds them inexpensively, we're going to give these people in Jamaica even less expensive. So one day, trucks pull up in front of the farmer's co-op, and a person sees that there's a case of potatoes for $2. Locally grown organic potatoes are $7. You go to your local dairy where you can get fresh milk or non-fat dry milk, and a quart of milk is $2, or maybe it's 50 cents. But the non-fat dry milk from America is a quarter. It doesn't take long before suddenly the economy starts to shift from local, sustainable, organic to export, coming into the country, imported in, and over a period of 3 to 4 years, you virtually destroy the entire sustainable agriculture of Jamaica.
Absolutely.
Then you have all these people having no longer no money, but also now, for the first time, many of them have had to try to sell their land or get mortgages. They start to migrate into the cities like Kingston or Montego Bay. Mm-hmm. They find that there is just poverty there. And the government, mainly Manley's government, which was a socialist government, does not have an income base. So in order to have a greater income base, it has opened up very precious cove areas with wonderful coral reefs and pristine public land to private development. So in come then the multinationals to sink in $100 million hotels. Well, all small places in Montego Bay, Ocho Rios, Port Antonio, that historically would be where a person could go and live for a week on a vacation and enjoy the local cuisine and entertainment and the Dingman's Falls and these wonderful mangrove forests, that's all gone now. Now you have 200 acres, you have a monolithic hotel, and the people no longer can work locally, they have to work here. And then you go out for a run in the morning, as I've done many times, and as you're running up the outside of the compound, you see there's guys with shotguns everywhere. And across the street are shanties. And here you see these men and women coming out in the morning, frequently with no windows in their houses, and they put on their little snap-on black bow ties and their white short-sleeve shirts and their black trousers and black shoes. And they come in and they go in and start to make the food, do the laundry, give beach towels. So what was at one time a poor but at least sustainable local economy is all gone. Everything's now imported. In fact, all the fish is gone because the hotels cannot rely upon what was once a thriving local fish business from people who have maybe 14-foot boats. They'd go out and late at night. They come back early in the morning. The fish women who sit under, they sit on a stool and they have two buckets. One is where they entrail the fish, and the other is where they wash it, and then the people from the local communities come in, the local people, as well as local local hotels, and they buy this. All that's gone, because now all the fish comes in is frozen, all the vegetables, frozen. So they don't even benefit the local economy. They all want everything standardized. Now you take a once healthy group of people and you begin to impoverish them. That leads to displacement off the land. That leads to the destruction of their natural environment. That leads to crime escalating. And now the local police can't maintain it, and there's not enough cooperation because the people who are becoming poor, their children see, they're not going to live a life of poverty. They get angry. Now you jump over to South America, where people are told by a corporation, Bechtel Corporation, we just made a deal with your government. We gave them a lot of money. We own your water. So every time you turn on a tap for drinking, cooking, or bathing, you're paying us. Oh, it used to be free. Now it's going to be as much as 20% of your actual monthly income. Pearson said, but we don't have that money. Well, then your water gets turned off. And this goes on for so long that finally the entire nation rebels. But up until that time, all the top people in the government, and this is true of all these governments, were fully complicit, because you know that they're all engaged at some point of being rewarded for going along. And then you have, on top of all that, you start to see that pristine rainforests are exploited for their hardwood so it can go to Japan. That's Brazil. That minerals that had laid dormant in Uruguay, that goes to China to make cell phones. That gigantic amounts of the rainforest are now cut down so that they can plant soybeans to feed cattle in China and Japan and in Europe. But it's causing desertification and rising temperatures and deforestation. And all behind this is the President of the United States, his entire cabinet, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg, the Trilateral Commission, all the major think tanks, and the media that support them, the stories they will not report on, they will not tell, and local politicians, national politicians, and the wealthiest in each country, as if a crime boss is saying, look, this is your neighborhood. We expect $1 million a month to come back to us. In return, you can do whatever you want with all the rest, and you can handle this the way you want. So in every country of the world, there is no exception, especially that punk-ass little country of England. What a demented group of people in that government there. I can't tell you the contempt I have for monarchy. In any case, I'd like to see them cleaning toilets. In any case, that would be an appropriate, at their intellectual level they're at, that would be at the right assignment. In any case, the elitist in every country, they're the ones who then have, for all intents and purposes, control. The hidden hand of the multinationals, the hidden hand of the international consortiums, the international control behind this by about 160 different corporations with about 37,000 people associated with them control virtually 60% of all this. And in front of all of it, to act as the savior is the World Bank, knowing full well that not a single person will be helped that needs it. They'll indebt this, but then they can screw the people because saying, we gave you the money, now you give us your oil, you give us your water, you give us your highway, you give us your forest, you give us your precious metals, you give us your water. That's what all this is about. Show me, please, where I'm in error.
You're not in error. You are actually absolutely on the dot. This is happening all over the place. The example you mentioned, I think, the example you mentioned at the beginning would be very fitting to Haiti. You know, that has happened when Clinton started helping, between quotes, Haiti. Haiti was had a self-sufficient, food self-sufficiency, especially rice self-sufficiency. People were not rich. Of course, they were poor. They're still poor, but they were not hungry. Now they are hungry. They have to import rice. They have to import all sorts of food. And that exactly happens, the example what you mentioned. You know, what they could afford before, because they had small farmers that were self-sufficient, they had their local markets, they're no longer the case. They can no longer subside with having to compete with imported food, highly subsidized imported food from the United States. This is one horrible example. Yeah, another one is that I lived through also and tried to fight, but to no avail, and which was pushed also by the World Bank, is the free trade agreement with Peru, the so-called free trade agreement. As you know, there's nothing free in it at all, especially not for the country. What I've analyzed the case in Peru particularly, out of the, of only, let's only talk about agriculture, because there are lots of other things involved. There is mining involved, there is hydrocarbons involved, the drug industry is involved, and all sorts of things. But just looking at agriculture, there are 11 crops are within this free trade agreement the United States has thrashed down the throat of Peru. And at least three of them are traditional long-term crops, like corn. You know, corn is several thousand years old. It comes out of the Andes, the original corn. They have about 700 kinds of different corns in Peru, all kinds of colors. Corn is on the list of food that can be imported, must be imported in the future, according to certain quotas, according to the free trade agreement. Another product is cotton. Cotton, if you look at Peru is a living museum, I call it, because there's so many cultural places around where you can see that cotton existed thousands of years ago in this country. Cotton is being gradually replaced by imported cotton from the United States, which, as we all know, is highly, highly subsidized. So is corn. And another one, which is not so old, but also about 300-400 years old, is rice. Rice is also on that list. And not only do we know that the farmers the small farmers who have been supplying the local markets in Peru with corn, cotton, and rice, and others, of course, but those are the ones which I picked out to analyze. They will no longer be surviving. They migrate to the slum areas of huge cities. And the slum areas, say for Lima, is almost uncontrollable. Nobody knows exactly how big Lima is. I would estimate at least between 10 and 11 million people, and it probably grows at the rate of about 6% per year by immigration. And these people, they live in poverty, they live in slums, their children die, they have a child mortality which is extremely high, like in the poorest countries of Africa. Yet they have the World Bank boasts of an economic growth rate between 5 and 7%. You know how this economic growth rate, what it actually means? It means that of that growth, 80% goes to 5% of the population. And the remaining 20% is distributed among the 95. And you could break it even further down. Actually, it promotes poverty. You know, it promotes poverty, it promotes, it destabilizes the country, it promotes unemployment, criminality. It is enormous what is happening with what the World Bank boasts and the IMF of the country is doing great. It has an enormous growth rate. And part of it, this is of course thanks to the free trade agreement, because now Peru can export to the United States the exotic fruits, exotic vegetables, whatever the U.S. Cannot get anywhere else. They buy from Peru, but it has to correspond to the norms of the United States. And the small farmer cannot produce anything that corresponds to these strict norms of the United States. So what happens? International corporations go in, they buy up local farms, and so it's mostly in the hands of U.S. corporations. The farmland gradually will go into more and more U.S. corporation hands that exploit the agriculture of Peru. And Peru is just an example that I keep using because I know it a little bit better than other countries. But it's the same all over Latin America.
Peter, you know, we are out of time. The hour has flown by. I'm inviting you back for part two, but you've given us a lot of good insights. So the next time someone hears about the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, just understand these are all part and parcel of a deeply malignant, interconnected cancer that has been living off the world and causing its suffering for decades. For 30 years, you were inside this institution. You saw it. You know it. You're speaking as an insider, a whistleblower. And I thank you very much for your honesty and your courage. And the book is called, for those of you who want to get a real exploration of this, Implosion. Now, that's actually a fictionalized novel, but it's based upon what he actually saw. We look forward to another conversation, Peter.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thanks a lot for having me. I'll be happy to talk to you again.
All right. And from Switzerland, Peter Koenig, but it's spelled K-O-E-N-I-G. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening.